It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This week, the Universities of Wisconsin announced a slate of budget proposals aimed at boosting the state's workforce, economy, and access to health care.
The system is seeking $240 million for programs that they say would train 300,000 workers and create 2,500 new businesses. Another $90 million, that would go to expand healthcare training.
That comes as the U.S. Department of Education is changing its rules around what degrees are classified as professional and which majors have access to federal student loans. Renee Wachter is interim president of the Universities of Wisconsin after serving as longtime chancellor of UW-Superior. President Wachter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good morning, Rob. It is great to be here.
Let's start with this healthcare professional side of things. This proposal called Healthy Wisconsin, aimed at training 35,000 healthcare workers over the next decade. What kind of things would need to happen on individual UW campuses to meet that goal?
Well, let me just take a step back and talk about, you know, how this particular proposal and promise was developed. You know, we spent a lot of time in the leading months coming up to this, you know, going around the state, talking to folks in our communities, talking to our businesses, as well as our campus leaders, our institutions that are located throughout the state that create this beautiful web. You know, and healthcare access certainly was one of the issues that came up. And, you know, frankly, coming from the Northland, you don't need a spreadsheet to understand what rural Wisconsinites are currently facing. And that is that when you have a shortage of healthcare professionals, you have longer wait times. Sometimes you can't get access to specialists. And sometimes, you know, folks may need to drive to have access to healthcare. So our 13 universities are really poised to accelerate the number of professionals that we are producing so that we're making sure that access is not an issue to receiving health care.
What does that look like on the ground then at individual campuses? Are they expanding current programs, starting new programs to train healthcare workers?
I think what the full details will be available on Monday, but I think you'll see a whole wide variety of initiatives, everything from developing programs to produce radiologists, to expanding nursing programs, to physician assistants. It really, the beauty of these proposals is that it really addresses the needs that are specific across various regions.
And you mentioned northern Wisconsin as having a need for workers, a lot of rural parts of the state. Is it going to be a priority to try to find ways to make sure that at least a portion of these graduates of these programs, once they're up and running, end up in rural Wisconsin, end up in northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of this. We know that, you know, our Universities of Wisconsin is really the state's best investment to mobilize and keep momentum going, especially in our rural communities. What this budget allows us to do is to really ramp up those partnerships that we already have and expand to new partnerships so that we're doing things like placing students in internships, giving them experience hands-on with these businesses to encourage them and show them that Wisconsin is a place where you can live and thrive and earn a living for you and a family that you may want to start.
Last year, the Trump administration rolled out a policy to reclassify nursing degrees, in particular, as not being professional. It's a kind of a complicated formula. It would affect the amount of student loans, though, available to nursing students, putting a cap on that. Do you have a concern that that could slow down your proposed effort to train more healthcare professionals here in the state?
I think we'll need to watch what happens in that federal space. You know, it tends to swing one way depending on the day that you wake up. But our commitment to Wisconsin and providing professionals will exist no matter what happens on the regulatory side.
We're talking to Renee Wachter, interim president of the Universities of Wisconsin, about some new budget proposals released this week. There's also initiatives called Tech for Tomorrow and Accelerate Wisconsin aimed at boosting other kinds of workforce development outside of that direct healthcare field. What does the career-ready part of this look like? What is the priority here?
We are trying to make sure a number of things, you know, when you're talking about helping fuel our businesses and also creating places where people, you know, go on to work and live within Wisconsin, it's going to take a number of things. And that is, number one, making sure that, you know, when they start with us, that they have the tools and supports to be successful. The other is making sure that we are reaching people where they are at. So not everybody can attend on a campus environment. We've got a lot of folks out there that are looking to either upskill or they are looking to seek additional credentials or to get in on the first place. And so creating programs that are accessible for them, whether that's competency-based learning, which basically says, hey, take what you've learned and let's apply that to college credit to get you going faster, to online programs. So if somebody is trying to juggle work, family, life, that they can still have that degree available to them. So that's just some of the things that we're looking at in this particular proposal.
With that accessibility issue, the system has closed down a bunch of the 2-year campuses around the state. That means for many people, that nearby campus, well, it's not quite as nearby anymore. How do you reach out to those communities, maybe especially those that lost those campuses, to say, yeah, you can join in these career-ready programs?
Yeah, we think we have tremendous opportunity in this space and are very excited. I mean, what our foremost is making sure that getting an education, getting that credential, getting that certificate is available to all Wisconsinites who want to seek it. And so, you know, we, whether that's today or whether that's looking at tomorrow, we're going to continue that pursuit of making sure that there are various options no matter where you are in the state so that you can advance your career.
How do you, as this program develops, if it's funded, how do you match what you're training people in around the system to what the employment needs are today, and acknowledging that employment needs change over time?
They do, and that's, I think, what really sets the universities apart is that we are training not just for the jobs for today, but also very conscious about those fundamental skills that prepare somebody when you don't know what that future is going to look like. You know, it is whether you're pro AI or anti AI, the fact is that it is changing people's lives. And it was something I think that was not on folks' radar screen probably about 10 years ago, but we're training people to be adaptable, to be those critical thinkers, to be those communicators, to be those team workers that are going to thrive no matter what the environment is out there.
Getting back to the federal level, the Department of Education announced earlier this summer a rule that says, hey, undergraduate programs, you've to be access certain kinds of federal loans and Pell Grants, you have to establish that your graduates make more money than they would have without a high school degree, same graduate students compared to undergraduate programs. That's raised concerns for things like early childhood education, social work, places where there are people needed, they're not lucrative. Do you have concerns about how that could affect student loans for some of these places where there is a need for workers?
You know, I think that federal space is challenging right now. We also know that it's very volatile, and certainly it's of concern for programs that cause many of our communities to thrive, whether you're talking about the arts or whether you are talking about things like early childhood. And we're just going to have to watch this space very closely to see how it plays out over the coming months.
You've mentioned a couple times watching that federal space. Is this something that the university is actively advocating on? Of course, you advocate at the state budget level. Are you making contact with federal lawmakers from Wisconsin to talk about these guidelines from the Department of Education?
We have been and always will be in close contact with both our local legislators as well as our federal representatives. And I can tell you that they are certainly supportive of the issues that go on within Wisconsin. So we continue to look, you know, for very productive dialogue over the coming months.
Now, these are budget requests we're talking about here. You don't know who the audience is at this point. It's election year. We don't know what the state legislature is going to look like. We don't know who the governor is going to be. How do you try to sell this, regardless of whether D's or R's are in charge in the state capitol?
I think, again, that that is just the beauty of this proposal and where why we are so excited about this, because it really does represent all Wisconsinites. These are challenges and issues that all Wisconsinites face. So I can't think of one community that's not affected by the quality of the health care that's available, or the concern that there are jobs available, or that people have the requisite skills to be able to obtain those jobs. So this is, you know, one of those proposals that really directly speaks to the things that challenge Wisconsin, but also can offer the momentum to keep things moving forward. Again, not just for today, but really trying to say, how are we going to position ourselves over the next decade to be a state that thrives and that its people can thrive when they're here?
Now, at this point, these are fairly broad proposals. It'll go to the legislature next year. What's the timeline like right now for fleshing out this plan. You mentioned more details coming, and for making it a formal budget request to the legislature.
So the typical process is, you know, we're speaking to the public. We want people to understand, you know, the investment that we're asking for in our state, in addressing these challenges. It goes before the full Board of Regents next week, after which it goes through a process in having conversations with the legislature and whoever is governor. And typically a budget is signed in probably sometime around that June or July period of 2027.
Now, there's probably a bunch of people listening right now saying, yeah, this all sounds great. We're looking at sending our kid to college next year. What's happening with tuition? As you craft these budget proposals, what are you looking at when it comes to the cost of higher education for UW system students?
I would say that we are always concerned about affordability. And we do know that the Universities of Wisconsin are one of the most affordable within the Midwest. We are always conscious of that. Tuition typically gets done in the spring, but I will also say that our universities offer tremendous value, that they really are gems in terms of what they're able to provide. I mean, coming as a chancellor from UW-Superior, I have seen firsthand how what we do on our campuses will change the trajectory of someone's lives. And so that's what I want people to think about out there is that this is truly an investment in somebody's future.
President Wachter, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Renee Wachter, interim president of the Universities of Wisconsin. We've been talking about a new series of budget proposals UW announced this week aimed at workforce training and business development. As a disclosure, Wisconsin Public Radio is a unit of UW-Madison.
Coming up, lucid episodes in dementia can be unexpected bursts of clear thought and communication with loved ones. A Wisconsin researcher studies the scientific mystery of these moments, and a caregiver shares an experience.
They're seeing a piece of their loved one again, but it's fleeting, and, you know, they might be hopeful.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A team of researchers in Wisconsin and Minnesota are leading one of the first large-scale studies investigating moments of lucidity in people who are living with dementia.
These lucid episodes are when the dementia patient experiences sudden clarity, even after severe declines in memory and cognitive abilities.
An episode could mean that they suddenly speak clearly, recognize loved ones, or show abilities once thought to be permanently lost.
Why do these episodes of clarity happen? And what could they be an indication of? What can caregivers do in those moments?
To learn more, we have one of the lead researchers. Andrea Gilmore-Bikovsky is an associate professor and vice chair of research in the Burby Walsh Department of Emergency Medicine at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Andrea, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Karen Wheelock has been a dementia care educator and advocate for over a decade. She's founder of the Dementia Care Alliance of Wisconsin. Karen, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea, starting with you, can you help us understand lucid episodes? What is lucidity and what do you know about these experiences for people living with dementia?
Yeah, absolutely. So lucid episodes are what I would really describe as an observed sort of transient recovery of abilities that we thought were perhaps lost in individuals who are living with advanced dementia. A challenging thing when you ask me to describe it is that we actually don't have an established definition for lucid episodes, but they have been reported in the medical literature going back hundreds of years and anecdotally are very familiar to people that are family caregivers or professional caregivers that have been working with people living with dementia, but they just really haven't haven't been scientifically studied very systematically.
Do these episodes, do they last minutes, hours? What are they like in terms of their length?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, as I go into answering that question, I want to provide us all with, as scientists often do, the caution that we know some things about lucid episodes, but we're really at the beginning of a focused field of research about these events and this phenomenon. So everything that we know has limitations so far. The duration of these episodes appears like it's quite variable. So some of these are very brief, and some of them could potentially last days.
Hmm. You've also received a federal grant through the National Institutes of Health. How will you go about collecting and analyzing these lucid episodes? What does this research look like?
In our approach to studying this, we have been conducting what we call sort of a longitudinal video observation study. So we are collecting video and audio data. And really the goal is to see if we can capture these events so we would have direct and observable information about them so we could characterize their features. What we do is we, as much as is possible in partnership with family members and clinicians, we collect video observations and we have people that are trained review them and we generate really detailed data from these videos. So we are measuring using something called computational linguistics, which is really characterizing the verbal output of individuals living with dementia. So things like utterances, intonation, pauses and gaps in speech. We also measure things like eye gaze and eye tracking and gestures so that we have a lot of detailed information about what the person living with dementia is doing and especially how they're communicating, because these events tend to show up, it seems, quite a bit in communication behaviors. And then we look for deviations. We look for really significant changes from what seems to be someone's baseline. And what we do when we see those is we find a knowledgeable informant and ask them to review that kind of raw video footage.
Karen, turning to you, your mom lived with Alzheimer's disease for 8 years, diagnosed before you were 30?
Yes.
She loved music, was a reading specialist. Can you describe your relationship with her and her struggles then with memory?
Yeah, for sure. So I had just started working in the senior care industry when my mom was diagnosed. And that made me want to learn as much as I could about Alzheimer's, as you might do if a very close person of yours is diagnosed with something. I had a very close relationship with her, you know, my whole life, really. Mm. And I am a musician, and music is very important to me. And it also was with my mom, and she played piano, and she liked to sing a lot. And that carried through to caring for her with dementia. And I've noticed it both personally and professionally that music can affect the brain differently than anything that I've seen for people that are living with dementia or even without dementia as well, you know.
Yeah.
So there were times with my mom where she wouldn't know who I was or know my name, but then she'd hear her favorite Carole King song and could sing every single word about, you know, 10 minutes later.
There was a lucid experience that your sister documented with your mom. What happened?
Yeah, so my mom, in 2020, she had a very random GI bleed and was hospitalized. It was at the beginning of COVID, unfortunately, so we couldn't be there with her. She was pretty much, I was told, not really, you know, she was very out of it that whole week that she was in the hospital. I don't know if it was due to the medication she was on, but also she was almost 8 years into her Alzheimer's diagnosis. So, but my sister had called her on the phone and they had a full out conversation. And that was, I think, right before she was deemed palliative. And then she was put on a hospice, and then 2 weeks later she passed away. So it was something where she was not able to really have a conversation even before the GI bleed happened. It had been like months for her to have, you know, be able to directly answer questions and have like, you know, appropriate answers to any questions that we would ask her. So it was pretty amazing to hear.
How do you reckon with that? What do you take away from that experience, even though you weren't there?
Right. So I always say that I was jealous at first. I'm not going to lie. You know, like she's talking to my sister, but I spent every day with her the last 2 weeks of her life, and I didn't get that, you know. But it does get a little personal, and I did ask my sister for permission to talk about this. So my sister, a couple years prior, she lost her baby when she was 7 months pregnant. Mm. And it was a very, very sad situation. When my mom was in the hospital and my sister called her up to talk to her, my sister was once again 7 months pregnant. Mm. So I think, like, in my head, I'm like, you know what? I think she really needed that.
As you hear stories like this and this one, how meaningful can these moments be for people?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, thank you, Karen, and thanks to your sister also for sharing that. You know, I think these moments can be really, really impactful, and I think that's actually one of the most important areas for research to focus on. I think sometimes we also know from our research that the response could be, you know, it's very positive and it's personally meaningful. And sometimes, even though it might be a wonderful thing and an opportunity, there can also be other complications where the response could be more neutral or more negative, just depending on where, you know, a particular caregiver might be, right? Relationships are complicated. And I think, you know, if someone perhaps has a lucid episode and your approach to how you maybe were coping with this really difficult and challenging experience of watching a loved one go through this is to say, I guess they're not here anymore. And then there's this event that tells you, oh my gosh, there have been times where you have been far more here perhaps than I've understood. And right now you appear to really be fully here with me. That's a lot for us to process, particularly when we don't have helpful explanations for family members about how these events are possible. And it doesn't match our understanding biologically of the disease process. You know, we describe Alzheimer's disease and other dementias as, you know, these are progressive, irreversible. Not everyone will exhibit lucid episodes, as far as we know, although they appear to be much more common, but people aren't really necessarily prepared for these events. So, you know, how do you respond in the moment? I think these are all things that people need support with. And I think people also need support to process the event after it occurs. And that's something that we really haven't developed, but I would love to see researchers start to address that more so that, you know, if someone has this experience, the clinician who they're sharing it with, they are able to support that person. This can complicate our grieving. And we need to find a way to make sense of it, even though we don't have all the answers, which I think, Karen, you just said, you know, there's a lot that doesn't make sense, right? And I think it tells us a lot that I really hope we don't need science to tell us about. I think it reinforces what I hope is humanistically imperative and evident, that is, you know, we need to assume that people are there and we need to assume they're present. And we need to do that regardless of what we learn as we keep studying lucid episodes.
We're talking about new research on lucid episodes and people living with dementia. That is Andrea Gilmore-Bikofsky, an associate professor in the Berbye Walsh Department of Emergency Medicine at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, leading a team of researchers studying these lucid episodes. And Karen Wheelock has been working in senior care for more than a decade. She has a special focus on patients living with dementia. Karen, you are also a musician. You mentioned the importance of music in, with your mother and caring and Alzheimer's, and you've seen firsthand how music affects people living with dementia. Is there a moment that stands out to you?
Yes, actually, it always comes up in my brain whenever I think about this. About 13 years ago, I was playing music at a memory care facility. It's something that I like to do, just kind of freelance music, old songs that people know at memory care facilities. And there is a gentleman sitting there, and he was in a wheelchair. His head was down. He was not responding to anything. I started playing the hymn In the Garden, and all of a sudden he looked up at me, and he stood up out of his wheelchair. And at first, because I didn't work there, I didn't know the person, I'm like, wait, is this safe? I hope that he's, you know, he's being safe and everything, but he was. And he just started singing every word. And I was like, what just happened? And then a staff member told me that he actually used to be a pastor and that he is able to stand and walk safely, but he has to be emotionally moved to do it. And he was not having a good day. And then he heard a hymn that he recognized, and that just kind of woke him up in a way. And I know that there's, you know, I mean, Andrea might be able to answer this a little better, but I've heard that there's a lot of research in how music can affect the brain in the way to help people.
In terms of music, Andrea, is music or maybe another trigger helping, you know, create these lucid moments, these lucid episodes, or are they not predictable or able to replicate so easily?
Yes, it's a really great question. There is a field of research focused on music and dementia, and I think we know that music promotes engagement, and we learn music differently than we learn language, and so perhaps there are different preserved abilities, and music also may be enjoyable. I think another good question and hypothesis is about what is personally meaningful to someone as an individual, and is music the necessary component, or is it also about what the music and the meaning of that music was to that person? Because I'm thinking of the story Karen shared, and this moved this person emotionally, and maybe other people have other outlets. In terms of thinking about lucid episodes and whether or not they can be triggered, we really don't have an answer to that question yet. One of the potential defining characteristics of a lucid episode is indeed their spontaneous nature, that they're unexpected and they don't have a consistent pattern. So potentially, definitionally, that would lead one to say if there's a consistent trigger, then it's not a lucid episode. So this is where it's challenging at this stage in the research. What I can share from our data is that the events themselves, they do appear, again, this is very preliminary data, they do appear to be quite spontaneous in nature, and that they're unexpected. So I think the field just isn't at a stage where it can be definitive, but other triggers are being investigated still.
This seems like such a prolific time for research across various different disciplines, Andrea. I'm wondering, where do you want your research on lucid episodes to go? How do you hope it's used?
I think for me personally, I'm really interested in understanding how we can support caregivers, how we can support clinicians. There are 7 million people that are impacted by dementias, and it seems from the studies that are being done so far that a number of them are going to exhibit lucid episodes, and someone's going to have to make sense of them. And they're going to need to be supported to understand what to do. We know from some research that some caregivers might make a change to a plan of care, such as someone's code status after witnessing a lucid episode. But we understand these events to be transient and not indicative of a full recovery or a full return, even though they present that way and they may appear that way to us and be so shocking in their intensity that they go away. So I think there's a lot to be done around what are we going to do about that? What types of supports do people need? How can we support clinicians when someone says, you won't believe what happened to my mom? There should be a nomenclature to help people process these events and to help them celebrate them when they feel good and to help them continue on that journey and integrate it with their journey.
Karen, as you hear that, I wonder what comes up for you in terms of an advocate and a dementia educator when a loved one sees or experiences this moment of clarity and what the family should be thinking and feeling in that moment that might go very quickly.
Yes, that is tricky. That is, I feel like working with a lot of family members of people that I've served who are living with dementia, there's always an amount of, you know, wanting to hang on to what they used to be. And just in my experience, I've seen that a lot. And I would think that it might bring some false hope for some folks where they're seeing a piece of their loved one again, but it's fleeting. And, you know, they might be hopeful, as Andrea said, that, you know, they might change a code status based on that. And that's a big decision, right?
Yeah.
I think definitely having support for them would be key.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
And Andrea, thank you for sharing this research and for this conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Karen Wheelock is a dementia care educator and advocate in the Madison area. Andrea Gilmore-Bikofsky is an associate professor and vice chair of research in the Burby Department of Emergency Medicine at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We've been talking about new research underway on lucid episodes in people living with severe dementia and why these moments of memory and awareness occur.
Coming up, a teenage MMA fighter from Kenosha is national champion and medaling on the world stage. Hear about his journey into combat sports.
The day I stepped on the mat, my first practice, completely fell in love with it, and then the competitions just kept getting bigger and bigger.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A Wisconsin teenager is gearing up to head to Columbia to represent Team USA in the Global Association of Mixed Martial Arts Pan American Championships next month.
17-year-old Andrew DeVito from Kenosha has already won a national MMA championship in the U.S. and medaled at world championship competitions in Brazil and Greece last year.
In September, he's heading back to South America looking for gold as he pursues his dream of fighting in the UFC.
We're checking in on DeVito's journey through combat sports and getting to know the broader MMA community here in Wisconsin. In addition to his own fights, he's also a Brazilian jiu-jitsu and kickboxing youth coach at Rothwell MMA in Kenosha. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get into mixed martial arts, and what got you hooked on becoming an MMA fighter?
Yeah, so I started about 4 years ago now. It was more just my parents wanted me to do self-defense. I literally did not want to do it at all. It was more just, yeah, the self-defense thing. I hated the idea of training. Wasn't that athletic or anything like that. But then the day I stepped on the mat, my first practice, completely fell in love with it. Yeah, after that first practice, I knew I wanted to compete. And then the competitions just kept getting bigger and bigger. And now we're here.
Now we're here. And you've said you train for about 7 hours a day. Can we walk in your footsteps for a bit? What is a typical day like for you?
Yeah, so it really depends. All of my days are, like, different schedules, but we'll take Thursdays out, for example. I'll get up in the morning, maybe like 7:30, take my breakfast supplements, and I'll drive an hour down to Chicago to go train down there from, like, 10 to 12. They've got some really good guys down there, a lot of UFC fighters, champions, Olympic medalists. So I'll spend my mornings down there, finish there at 12, drive an hour back to Kenosha, so I'll be home at 1. From like 1 to 2:30, I'll eat, shower, And then there I'm just like watching film on training. Then I'll be back in the gym at 3, and from 3 to 4, well, 3:30 to 4, I have a private lesson that I do kickboxing. 4 to 5, I'll have my MMA sparring. And then for the rest of the night, I have more kickboxing training and grappling. I'll be done at the gym at 8. So 10 to 12 in the morning, and then 3 to 8:30 again in the evening.
That is a long day.
Yeah.
How do you keep your energy up? How do you stay so focused on this sport?
I mean, I'm just thinking about like what my opponent's doing. I feel like that's the biggest thing. I always want to work harder than them. That's the motivation. Like if there's a day I just don't want to train, I just think, all right, my opponent's training right now also, so I gotta do one more minute or one more hour or one more exercise more than him. So maybe I take it to a little bit of an extreme, but I don't find myself getting burned out. I just want to be the best and outwork everybody. So that's kind of where my motivation comes from.
How did this combat sports career escalate to the point where you're competing in world championship events that are recognized by the IOC, the International Olympic Committee? What has that jump been like into these competitions?
Yeah, it's been awesome. Like I started just doing local fights in the Milwaukee area. I went to nationals, so once I won nationals, qualified for Team USA. Now I've like within 1 year, I've been to London, Brazil, and Greece. Soon to be Colombia now, all for international competitions. And it's awesome though, seeing like knowing that I'm at that level. Like I'm still undefeated in the USA. And competing internationally and being the best fighters in the world is a really good feeling. And it's awesome knowing that I'm able to compete with the best. And being able to travel and learn like from other fighters from different countries is awesome. And it happened very quick. But I'm loving it.
What have you learned from fighters in different countries? Are there different styles, different techniques?
Oh, there's 100% different styles. Fighting guys like Russia, they're super wrestling heavy, pressure, very strong. So you can always learn from a lot of the guys. Fighting guys from like when I go to Colombia next month, I'll be fighting guys from South America and Central America. So I'm expecting to fight a lot, maybe like strikers, because that's what they're more known for down there. And it's awesome being able to like pick up small tips and tricks from other countries, because like after we fight, we're friends, you know, like before the fight, we're here to fight, obviously, and we're serious. But right when the fight finishes, we'll hug, talk it out, learn from each other. So that's what makes it kind of beautiful.
I'm a mom, and I'm wondering, wow, how your parents might experience your fighting career so far and what it feels like for them when you go into a competition.
Yeah. So when I first started, like my mom would be terrified, like holding the camera, like shaking and super scared, super nervous. But the more I do it, like the better. Now they're better about it. Before they were scared, but now they just think it's really cool, awesome. They're super supportive of it. But yeah, they used to be scared, but now it's support, and they love it.
Do you worry about getting hurt in the ring?
I mean, it's always in the back of my head, but I'm not super nervous about it. Like I know it's possible, but I've been lucky so far to not have experienced any serious injuries as of now. But no, I just trust my training, trust I'm doing everything right to avoid my injury, just staying as healthy as possible, and I haven't had any issues so far, so.
How do you strike a balance with your MMA training from dawn to dusk and going to these competitions while also going to school and finishing your education? How does that work?
Yeah, so I mean it's a lot. Like over summer is when I'm trained the most. In school, I'm able to get pretty much all my homework done in school. We don't get in a crazy amount, so I'm able to just grind it out in school, get it done. So then I'm in school until 3 o'clock, and then at 3:30 I'm in the gym till 8 o'clock, and then get home at 8:30 and sleep. So it's an all day thing. Preparing for my last fight, I needed time to lift, so I'd wake up at like 4:30, and I'd be lifting in the morning before school, and then train right after school. But leading up to my last fight, I wanted to train at that gym in Chicago I was talking about before, and their practices were only around like noon, so obviously at school hours. So my school was able to write off a form where I could miss every Thursday to go down there and train to prepare for my fight. So the school supports it a lot, honestly. Like if I need to miss days to go train and I have all my homework in, they'll write off a paper and let me do it. So it helps out a lot.
So they are definitely in the loop
Oh, yeah.
on your MMA goals. I wonder what that journey looks like. How do you make the jump to UFC or one of the other top fighting companies? How do you get there?
Yeah, so once I'm 18, I'll start fighting amateur. Probably get five, maybe six fights under my belt as an amateur, depending on how my career goes. Then make the transition to pro. That might be around the age of 20, and then build up a good pro record. It's a long journey. But once you get maybe 7-0 pro around there, then that's when UFC starts becoming a possibility. So it's still a long road, but it's got to build the amateur record, build the pro record, and then UFC will reach out, your managers will reach out, and that's really how you get signed.
Right now, though, you're probably pretty much laser focused on the Pan American Championships in Colombia. What does that preparation look like for you?
Yeah, this is probably my most intense and my best fight camp. This is the best I've ever felt. Again, like my training days are very booked. But no, it's really the same as every fight though. Like I treat every fight, whether it's just a local amateur fight that doesn't have too much, reward to it, or a world title, I treat them all the same. A fight's a fight, right? So my training's the same as every fight, just Chicago, Kenosha, training hours and hours a day, strength and conditioning, technique training, everything I can do, like my nutrition, everything I can do to be the best, I'm on it, so.
Well, Andrew, all the best to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That is Andrew DeVito, a 17-year-old national MMA champion from Kenosha. He was with us to share his success in the combat sports and his preparation for the upcoming Pan American Championships in Colombia, where he will represent Team USA. Now we're taking a step back to look at the MMA community more broadly in Wisconsin. Eric Anderson is co-owner of Ironworks Training Center in Holman and a promoter for the semi-annual Three River Throwdown MMA event next month in Onalaska. Eric, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So when we talk about mixed martial arts, what all is included under that umbrella?
Mixed martial arts varies from wrestling to jiu-jitsu. That's more your grappling side of it. Your stand-up side is boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai. So it's a little bit of everything.
What kind of interest are you seeing in combat sports around Western Wisconsin, where you are?
Coming up in September will be my 27th Three River Throwdown show, and they've gotten bigger and bigger every year. My last one was in April, was probably the biggest one I've had. So we're getting more people wanting to get on the show. So yeah, it's definitely growing.
How much youth involvement are you seeing coming up in MMA?
Youth involvement is huge. We never used to do any so youth MMA is called pancration. It's basically amateur MMA with no head strikes. And then probably about 3 years ago, there was just so much interest with the pancration fights. We started to do some on our shows, and now I do about three or four pancration fights to start off every one of my shows now.
What kind of community are you building there around MMA in Wisconsin? Do you find that there's a lot of crossover and there are a lot of people making connections?
Oh, for sure. With being a promoter, I deal with, pretty much every gym in the Midwest and even further. So, and then also being a gym owner, our guys will go train at multiple gyms, and guys will come to our gym and train just to get different looks. And yeah, so people are traveling all over to get different training sessions in.
When you do have these younger fighters getting into the sport, what extra precautions do you have to take for their safety compared to, you know, full-grown adults?
Well, like I said, with the youth, anyone under 18, there's no head strikes at all, so that really helps with their training. So they're not getting punished that way. They do the grappling, you know, and stuff like that. But with no head strikes, it keeps them pretty safe.
What do you hear from parents about why they want their kids training to fight?
Well, kind of like Andrew said in the previous interview, you know, a lot of the parents want their kids to do self-defense. We get a lot of the young kids in there that, you know, start out with just jiu-jitsu for self-defense, and then they just fall in love with it. So then they transition to some striking, and then they fall in love with that. And then it's full MMA they want to do. So I would say when they're younger, it's mostly starting out with like a self-defense.
What makes an exceptional MMA fighter in your mind?
Drive. You have to be willing to put in the extra work. You know, the good MMA fighters are at the gym, you know, 6 days a week, hours and hours at a time. So if you want to excel in a sport, you have to have the drive. You have to love it. You have to want to do it, and put in the work, because all the high level MMA fighters are doing it.
You know, most people fighting in MMA events like yours and others around Wisconsin, they won't become the UFC superstars who are earning the big bucks. What motivates them to step into that cage, to step into the ring and you know, risk getting that punch in the face?
I mean, you talk to any of them, I mean, that's their goal is the UFC, you know, and most of them think that they can get there by putting in the work. So it's not like someone's coming to the show thinking, oh, I'm just going to do this and get beat up. And they all are confident. They all think they're going to go somewhere. So that helps out a lot.
What kind of experience do you want to give spectators who go to Three River Throwdown? What should that feel like for your people in the crowd?
I, as a matchmaker, I try to match up, you know, pretty competitive fights. So they're all even. And with the Three River Throwdown, like I said, it's, you know, this is my 27th show doing it. And probably half of the crowd come to every single show, whether they know a fighter, whether they, they're there to watch someone, they're just there to, you know, to watch the fights, because I feel we put on, you know, one of the best events in the Midwest. So people just come to have a good time and see some good fights.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Anderson is co-owner of Ironworks Training Center in Holman, with us to share his experience with the MMA community in Wisconsin. Earlier, we heard from 17-year-old Andrew DeVito of Kenosha, who is a national MMA champion and competing in the Pan American Championships in Colombia.
Here's a food question for you. Where do you go for the best burger in Wisconsin? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232.
Monday on the show, we'll hear from hamburger expert George Motes about a new edition of his book, Hamburger America, and he has a lot of Wisconsin entries in there all over the state.
And you can get that conversation started right now. Let us know your favorite bar, or restaurant, or stand, or whatever. Hey, maybe it's your own grill to get a burger. And we could even include alternatives to beef burgers.
Again, email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text. That number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Mackenzie Crummy, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.